Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC-LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everybody. Thank you so much for being here. The homegrown folks rocking it out. Kind of like the Baroque music today. I am Rick Moore, Sunday morning wake-up call, doing our own thing today about music, the history of Charlottesville music, regarding Charlottesville music. Several guests in the studio. Rich Tarbell here.
Good morning, Rick.
How are you?
Doing great. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for walking over.
Yeah,
is that what it was? From
pretty
the place in the back?
Yeah.
Your new book, somewhat new anyway, regarding Charlottesville music and oral history. So we're going to let you go oral for an hour.
Right. Yeah, we'll have, I'm happy to talk about it. Happy to be back here in the studios and happy to have a couple guests alongside of me that I brought along.
Yeah, we're going to have Stephen Barling here from Barling and Collins, also a former writer, still former?
Yes, I don't write for Siebel anymore.
No? Known as the Cripsy Duck.
That's right.
And we're going to get into that within the hour as well. We also have Kirby Hutto, who's the GM at Sprint Pavilion.
Good morning.
Good morning. Also helped get that Fridays After Five going. Now the thing.
Many years ago,
many
yes.
Many years ago. People always want to see what's coming up this Friday, looking ahead in the calendar to see where they need to be or what sort of music they need to be planning to dance to on their Friday. So that's what we've got for the hour. Be prepared. Get ready. So that you can know what you're going to be learning about history of Charlottesville music. Rich, your book, you can buy it in that beautiful large copy you have on your side of the counter, full of photos, beautiful photos. Who helped you put that together?
I self-published that. So that is that was a project I took on. It was my when I started this in 2017, it was my 30th year in town. And I wanted to do something photography related and music related. That's what I do. That's what I'm passionate about. So I came up with this idea of doing portraits of local musicians and had two kind of connotations with that. One, I did it in their own creative spaces just to A, give them a comfort level, and B, make it very simple to do in one space with one light and very portable for me. So as I did that, I was thinking, is this interesting? Where are we going with this? I couldn't really figure it out. I just wanted to do it. And I had them, so I didn't just photograph my friends. I had started with two people who I kind of consider the matriarch and patriarch of the Charlottesville music scene to me, is Jamie Dyer, the Hogwaller Ramblers, and Terry Allard. And I had them, I photographed them, and then I asked them for two names of who to photograph next. And I kind of worked my way with that roadmap. And then, so it wouldn't just kind of be that, I hate to call it Terry Allard old, or we can call it Jamie Dyer old. But so it wasn't just the older musicians. I started a similar thing with younger people, which was Coda Curl from Chamomile and Whiskey and Sally Rose of Shagwolf and Sally Rose Band, and had them pick two people too. So I kind of had a roadmap started at two ends of the Charlottesville music scene, the younger and the older. And that gave me the names of who to go to. And each person I photographed, I said, can you give me two more names? And that's how I came up with, it ended up being 110, 112 people that I photographed. But the second person I photographed was Sandy Gray from the Hogwaller Ramblers. And we did his picture in like 5 minutes and it was perfect. And he started telling me all these stories about the old days of him playing at the Prism on Rugby Road, the old Prism. And just fascinating stuff to me. And I said, can I turn my phone on, just record some of these stories just for prosperity's sake? And he's like, sure. So We were done his portrait in 5 minutes, and we talked for 55 minutes. And that's where I had the idea to maybe pair the photographs with an oral history. And that's really how that just organically started.
Kirby and Stephen, you both have gone through the book. Yes. It, nodding your head doesn't do any good now, Stephen.
They can't see that on the air?
No. So, Stephen, how many of these folks have you played with? Because Charlottesville is known for, I'll use the word organic, it's already been tossed out there, organically playing with musicians, playing with other musicians, whether you, because you play in many bands or because you hop up on stage with one another or you end up at somebody's house on the porch playing with somebody. And Kirby, because you have been booking bands for a lot of your professional life, how many of these musicians have you worked with? So,
Stephen? I mean, I've played with, you know, various handfuls of them, but I'm familiar with 85% of them. I mean, a lot of them are local standbys for years and, you know, the classics and new up-and-coming people who you check out when you get a chance. But, you know, it's we do get around. Charlottesville does share a lot of stages, and, you know, I know them all pretty much.
And both of you are in this book as well with your stories. Kirby?
I've been aware of most of the people in there, but what was fascinating was the stories that Rich found that had never hit my radar. I mean, just, you know, sort of what we were talking before we started, the concentric circles, you know, where you're within your circle and you know, you're aware of the others, and then there's still some groups out there that, you know, you just never heard of or saw. But as far as booking, gosh, I probably have booked, you know, 70% of the people in there over the years, you know, starting from fraternity parties in the late 70s, 80s, up through, you know, the beginnings of Fridays After Five in the early 90s to now with the Pavilion and the continuation of Fridays After Five. So, you know, it's great to have seen all the various kind of collaborations over the years. You mentioned Sandy Gray. Good God, man. He was one of the first people I saw play when I came to Charlottesville in the fall of 76. With the band Ham and Eggs, who were fabulous. And, you know, then he's been in Hogwarts Ramblers, played with the All-Stars back for a while. So, you know, sort of following all those threads through is what's so fascinating. And this book is the first that anybody's made a serious effort to sort of pull it all together. So kudos to Rich for that.
You're here.
Thank you.
And we'll mention this throughout the hour, the book itself, where can we find this?
The book, you can get it on my website, richtarbell.com. It's available in paperback or hardcover. The hardcover is a little expensive. It's a photography book. It's like a wedding book. It's 300 pages, full color. It's not cheap, but it is. That's what it has to be, unfortunately, because the production is so high and it's self-published. I'm only making, you know, a few hundred copies. The paperback's $20. That has the complete oral history and then a couple pictures that I just selected from the book. Just kind of help with narrative more than anything. The book is also available at New Dominion Bookshop downtown. The downtown mall has both the hardcover and the paperback. And then some other select places around Charlottesville have the paperback, like Plan 9, where I think you went.
Plan 9 right across from... WPVC.
Right. And Mincer's has some copies. I just had to restock literally on a Friday morning, graduation weekend morning. I went over to the UVA bookstore and restocked them because they had run out and they were desperate to get some for the graduation weekend. So they have some. And Sidetracks has some copies too downtown.
Very nice. Again, so you you can pick this up regarding Charlottesville music and oral history by Rich Tarbell. The website or then several places here in Charlottesville. Our guest today, Rich Tarbell, the author and artist, is really what this book is, in the studio today along with Kirby Hutto. He's the GM, general manager at Sprint Pavilion, and Stephen Barling, who's a musician, and a journalist for many years, 20 years, right, at the Seville Weekly.
Well, I mean, I only wrote Cripsy's Crawl for 2 years right around the millennium. That's all the only time I actually did hardcore music journalism. But yes, I have been writing and shoot. I'm still a photographer for Seville. I shoot for their Abode magazine a lot.
And, there you go.
Yeah.
So let's talk about one of the ongoing topics throughout the book are the venues. So let's talk about some of the venues that come out in the book. There's the historical and the unique aspects. Let's talk about some of the historical aspects. Prism Coffee House was already mentioned.
Right.
What role did that play in the history of Charlottesville music?
Wow. The fact that I never went to the Prism Coffee House in the 70s when I was in town is one of the big regrets. I was an ATO fraternity brother, literally across Gordon Avenue from the Prism. We were a rock and blues house, and through tremendous live music parties, we kind of looked down on the Prism Coffee House. Well, you don't want to go there.
You were right across the street.
Literally right across the street. But then you look at who they brought to town. I mean, Emmylou Harris, 50 Cent cover in like 1977 or 78. You know, just tremendous talent on the national level, you know, who came through that little room. You know, by the time I finally discovered it and respected it, you know, it was in the, I guess, probably the late 80s. And, you know, it would still, you can just go there and be, you know, it's like, so-and-so is really playing the Prism.
That was the thing about the Prism, was that these acts who were booking 1,000-seat rooms would come and play the 50-seat Prism because it was this really intimate environment where they could really get close to their audience. And they'd do these rarity shows at the Prism for some reason.
Yeah. So, I mean, that was, that kind of was the, you know, one of the outlets to bring in the larger names. And I think it was just really underappreciated at the time, certainly by me.
There's also a lot of notoriety went to the Mine Shaft.
Right. The Mine Shaft was, is that the Draftsman Hotel they just built? It was underneath Studio Art. For those people before
the time. Yeah, it's the Draftsman.
The Draftsman Hotel is that kind of orange-trimmed building hotel there near the corner. Mine Shaft was located underneath Studio Art, which was a business that was there forever. And that was open 7 days a week. And that was your venue where it had national acts occasionally, like especially bands, I guess, going from D.C. to Atlanta or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
And they could stop in Muddy Waters or whatever, would stop in on a Sunday night and do the Mine Shaft as a place to get between the two as a fill-in or whatever. But you also had your Skipcasters doing, what, every Monday night there for several years?
For ages, yeah. I mean, that was...
But it opened 7 days a week and people playing every night, basically. And, that one of... Trax was maybe more known because it is a bigger space, bigger people, or more people, bigger bands. But the Mine Shaft seemed to be the one place that kind of is right in everybody's wheelhouse for that nostalgia era of that was my best time. So those were the greatest times. But really, if you look at some of the pictures of my book that I got from Chuck Taylor, who's an amazing photographer, who was doing stuff in the 70s, Mine Shaft is kind of a dump.
It was a dump.
My memory.
It was a death trap dump.
Yes, it was a dump.
Because it was in the basement of the building. There was one stairwell going down. At some point, the building inspectors made Leon put a second fire exit on the backside, but he always locked the door. So, I mean, if anything ever went wrong in that room, you were a goner. But boy, I mean, the walls would sweat. You know, seeing people like Muddy Waters, Robert Palmer, some of the great New Orleans bands, the Radiators, the place would just be jammed. I mean, it was literally at the point where you could not physically fit another body in and just rocking out. It was wonderful.
Now, I came to Charlottesville in 1982 to go to
right.
UVA. So reading this book is what told me, oh, I showed up just in time, or maybe... you know, a year or two later, because when I got here, the Mousetrap was still open, and what was upstairs? above the Mousetrap.
The Garrett.
The Garrett was still open for another year or so. So I got here just in time for all this, you know, great stuff to be happening. But of course, at the time, you don't know that.
Right.
And, you know, you're 18, so you don't always understand everything. But when we went to the mine shaft, my memory of the mine shaft is there was carpet on the walls.
Yeah.
And you, not being a musician, you don't understand that part of that is for the acoustics. And but you're like, there's carpet on the walls. What kind of place is this? But, you know, reading the book, you understand, oh, wow, what a cool place.
Right, right. The other thing I remember is stacks and stacks of bottled beer cases.
Oh, yeah. That was back when beer was still returnable bottles.
Right.
You know, so they would, you'd empty them, they'd go right back in the case and get stacked up everywhere.
All over the place.
Until the beer distributors came in the next day and swapped them all out again.
Right, because everything was worth a nickel. And if for every beer, that every bottle that got broken or lost, that was a nickel of lost income.
And that adds up.
Yeah. Again, 15:16 after the hour here, as we're talking with Kirby Hutto and Stephen Barlane and Rich Tarbell about the history of Charlottesville music. Regarding Charlottesville music and oral history is Rich's recently released book. Some of the other historical places, C&O, which people now have the concept of the restaurant, but at the time, in this time period we're discussing, also had... Is club the right word for it?
Yeah. Oh, just, I mean, again, a classic venue, basement of a building. You'll notice a theme there. You know, people were finding finding these open spaces that they could get into for very inexpensive. And, you know, Sandy opened the C&O Club.
Sandy, who now owns Daedalus Bookstore.
Correct.
Sandy McAdams.
And again, same thing, you know, national artists would float through there. You know, it's kind of amazing how the talent that he was able to bring. Small club, sort of a tall stage in the corner, a bar along the back, and same thing, elbow to elbow, just packed. I mean, that was back in the day when 7 nights a week you could go out and see live music. And the bars just kept it coming.
Now, Rich, I'll let you, I'm going to say this and I'll let you get into your new piece. And you have a piece that you're going to want to bring up about a YouTube thing that you're going to release, which you let me get a link into and watch last night. At the time, I had no idea. I went to a C&O show, 1984, maybe. One of those things that you're a UVA student, you're... space of Charlottesville is the grounds and not much else. And so somebody was playing at C&O and you're like, what is this area of Charlottesville that I've never been to and not sure I want to return to? But I saw Southern Culture on the Skids there, which may now be one of the greatest shows I've ever seen. And seeing it in the C&O may be one of the greatest places that I've ever seen a show at. And then I, Rich, your YouTube piece that I want you to talk about for 60 seconds, because we got to take our break, includes asking people, what's the greatest thing you've ever seen?
Yeah, for your show, I'm debuting a short documentary that we did at the book signing release party that we had for the book in October. And I had a small camera crew interview people at the signing and say, you know, where was your favorite venue? What was your favorite experience? And what have you. So you see, I want to say there's probably 20 people in it coming and going. talking about all this history. It's really interesting. So you can go to richtarbell.com. It's the top thing on the page. It's a YouTube thing, 50 minutes long. Probably see some friends in it. And I think you guys were in it, right? Were you? Did we interview you guys? No? Okay. Well, you were at the party.
Yeah.
But
in the background, drinking beer.
Yeah, exactly. So it's an interesting little piece. It's not going to win any Academy Awards or anything, but it's a cool little documentary piece for people who are interested. Just go to richtarbell.com, and it's a YouTube link.
Yeah, it was pretty interesting. And we'll mention that again throughout the hour. Again, our guests, Rich Tarbell, Kirby Hutto, Stephen Barling. And I'm going to come back from the break and ask you your favorite pieces. Be right back. All right, back in action as we talk about the history of Charlottesville music, carrying us into it with a Regarding Charlottesville Music book, an oral history by Rich Tarbell, who was kind enough to join us today and bring along Stephen Barling, Cripsy Duck, finally showing his face along with the name, and Kirby Hutto, GM of Sprint Pavilion. Gentlemen, so what was your favorite venue and show that you got to see over the last 30 years?
That's a tough one. I always have trouble, you know, evaluating art on a qualitative scale. But
yeah, it's tough to say that one. I don't know, but that one.
But
yeah,
there are some highlights. I mean, the CNO was just an awesome bat cave of a brick-walled venue. It was a really cool place to go see bands. But like, you know, now we have way nicer places to go see groups at the Jefferson and the Paramount and the Pavilion. These are really nice venues to see bands in. But one of my very favorite shows, actually, and I'm an old Deadhead. But one of my favorite shows was probably about 1986. It was the Dead Kennedys playing at Trax. And man, oh man, was that an incredible show. I mean, maybe I was just a dumb kid and being thrown around, you know, and getting boot prints on my back for the first time. And it was just incredible, you know. So that's one of mine.
And as I recall, way oversold.
Oh, man. It was just a sea of bloody kids in there.
Yeah. Yeah. And fire marshal would not have been happy.
Wow.
I think
if the fire marshal had thought that many people might have bought a ticket at the time, maybe they would have shown up and paid attention.
I believe Maynard Sipe promoted that show or put that show on. And I think the track's capacity was, what, 770 or something like that? And I think he said they sold 1,200 tickets.
For like $2 each or something.
Right, and then he said that everybody was so skeptical that they're like, why are you bringing the Dead Kennedys here? And they were bringing people in from Roanoke, were calling for tickets and everything. That's back when you had to call to buy your tickets.
Right.
Yeah, none of this going online nonsense.
Kirby, so what's a favorite show of yours or in a favorite venue?
God, I'm going to go way back to the West Virginian, which was, again, a basement club under the Virginian on the corner. Tiny, dangerous. But just one show that sticks out is Tex Rabinowitz and the Bad Boys. Tex was this older rockabilly singer with an incredible band out of D.C. And it was the first time he played Charlottesville, and there was just tremendous buzz. Like, all the musicians were like, oh, you got to go see Tex Rabinowitz. And, yeah, it's one of those shows that you go to and you just, you know, blown away. And it's at some point during that era, that was life changing. That's when music kind of became, you know, a driving focus for me. It's like, I want to be involved in this. And, you know, being a young, impressionable kid from Northern Virginia coming into this town during that era when there was just so much variety of music, it made an impression. And, yeah, that's one that just still sticks in my mind as just a classic show.
Well, you mentioned life-changing. One of the things that Rich's book mentions as, and I don't know if life-changing is a word that you use, but that I thought of when you start talking about it was Muldowney's and how... is the proper pronunciation of the last name Schatzman?
Yes, Joan.
Joan Schatzman turns over her restaurant because in Virginia you can't have just a bar. Right. You have to have a restaurant. and sell over 50% food to have a liquor license. But she wants to have a place for alternative kids, right?
Well, I don't know that she wanted to have a place for the alternative music kids. It was Muldowney's was downtown in what kind of across the street, the Waterhouse building's over top of it now. It's across the street from where the Main Street Arena is being torn down and all that. It's in that block there. And it was the first gay club in Charlottesville, primarily kind of a lesbian club, but it was the first true gay club in Charlottesville, or gay bar, if you will. And I think some of the punk kids, or hardcore kids, what have you, went to her and said, we need a place to play. Like, as always, the punk kids never have a place. All right. Yeah. They don't drink a lot. They're young. They're always looking for, and they're creative about where they play, where they can play. And they went to her and said, we'd like to play. And she's like, well, you can have, we'll try it. You can have next Thursday or whatever. And then the Thursdays turn into every first Thursday of the month. They would have hardcore nights. And it developed into the scene where some of these guys are still around and making music to this day. The Landlords and bands like that are having reissues, you know, 30 years later, the records that they made back then are being reissued with proper vinyl by a guy named Sam Richardson in Richmond. He's a young guy. You know, he's discovered this. And so it's kind of, you know, that music where it was, didn't have a home, didn't have a place. It was actually really good stuff for that genre that still, it's getting respect today. But that was, that bar just opened the door of giving them a shot. Or giving them a scene, and it got pretty big. I mean, you know, Dave Grohl from the Foo Fighters and Nirvana, his band Scream came from D.C. and played multiple times in this little bar, and it wasn't basement this time, but it was at the end of the back of a hallway, and it was pretty rough, you know. But that's what the downtown mall. People I don't think when we talk about it, and we'll talk about it later with Fridays and all that with the downtown mall. People that weren't here in the '90s or the '80s don't realize the downtown mall wasn't this giant boutique cosmopolitan food court that it is now. It was kind of sketchy back in the day.
It was dead.
I mean, there were a bunch of empty buildings, and you know, the whole concept of the mall was being rethought. It's like, you know, serious thought. Do we pull the bricks up and reopen Main Street? And that was in the early '90s, I guess. So yeah, the mall has not always been what you see today.
And also the connection between the university and the mall, like you were saying earlier about going to the CNO to see Southern Culture, that concept of a student getting down to the mall or walking was like not, that was not
right.
Happening.
I mean, I don't know when it happened, but was it the late 1990s or early 2000s that they put that trolley in?
Right.
Yep.
And at least you had some accessibility, but I did the same thing. I saw Danny Gatton at the CNO. As a student, exactly. As a student, but I was like, that was a
long way away with a lot of dirty places to cross to get there.
Exactly.
And when you got there, you're like, where am I parking?
Exactly. And now you see students on their bikes, or now we got these crazy little scooter things or whatever. And it's nothing to go downtown back and forth, but that wasn't the case back in the day. It was two separate, completely separate entities. And the downtown mall was, it was struggling. I wouldn't say it was failing, but it was fledgling.
There were two or three businesses open at night. That was it.
Yeah,
Miller's in the CNO.
Yeah,
Miller's in the CNO, and then
Fellini's.
Yeah, Fellini's came along.
And Fellini's has gone through a lot of changes.
Oh yeah,
from then to now as well. Well, what made Joan Schatzman take that chance? I mean, was she just that sort of individual because she wanted to have the lesbian bar, and so she also felt that it was fine to give somebody else the chance as well?
I'd hate to say what she was thinking, but what she gave me the impression when I talked to her was she wanted a bar for her and her friends. She had her crew of people that she hung with, and they would go to these bars or this bar. Like, we can have our own bar. And so she did. She just started her own bar. I think she's kind of has an entrepreneurial spirit. And she started this, and they just came to her. So I don't even think she will tell you. I don't think she went more than one time on the Thursday night. Too loud for her, too fast, too aggressive. But she had a bar manager said, this is your night. You take it. That'll be my night off. But she welcomed it, and it was a success. And you talked to some people like Colin Blecky, who's still around town. He's a professor at PVCC and still plays in all sorts of bands around town. You talk to those guys, and they're like...
He was one of the guys from that hardcore, yeah, or one of the first hardcore,
exactly,
bands.
Maybe played the first show ever there. If not, it was the second one with his band, The Landlords. But they still talk about that was important to them. They miss it, and it meant something to them.
Well, let's move a street over to the downtown mall itself, the mall that was the road that was blocked off. How did the music scene help the mall grow? I mean, we have Kirby Hutto here, the general manager of Sprint Pavilion. We have Stephen Barling here, who wrote for the Seaville Weekly, whose office is planted on the downtown mall. And the writing that was done, certainly a lot of musicians come out and play in the restaurants that are now on the downtown mall. How does the music scene help the downtown mall grow? If not in the 70s, certainly in the second half of the 80s and the 90s, I would think.
You know, I was hired to run Fridays After Five in 92. Now, it had already been going for a couple of years, but they were booking mainly corporate bands from out of town.
Wedding bands. Cover bands.
Yeah, you know. You know, the whole event was kind of iffy. I mean, they were, you know, it was the cheapest beer in town on a Friday night. So you're getting the people who want the cheapest beer in town on
it
a Friday night.
It reminded me of when I went to school, and probably any of you three who went to UVA, reminded me of Grad Happy Hour.
A little bit,
Was awesome. Yeah, absolutely. It was that loose, right?
Well, there was nothing special about it. And, you know, when I was hired, one of the things that I said in the interview is, why are you paying all these out-of-town bands when you've got such great local talent here in town that is desperate for a larger stage to play on? And so, you know, and from the next several years when I ran it, we really shifted that focus to booking the local talent and giving them a chance to play in front of, you know, a pretty good-sized crowd. And it really started to bring people downtown in the evening hours that otherwise there was not an attraction for. And, you know, I think that at that point, you know, some of the other entrepreneurs and artistic people who had businesses realized, hey, we can start doing more music. And, you know, I think it did. It kind of jump-started things to shift the focus of the downtown area from a 9-to-5 retail into a more of an entertainment and arts and dining district, which is what you see down there now. You know, it took a while, but you finally got that critical mass of, you know, nighttime attractions to where people, you know, you're not having to make this big effort to go downtown. It's like, well, let's go downtown and see what's going on, which is a completely different mindset. And that ultimately led to the restoration of the Paramount, the restoration of the Jefferson as live entertainment venues. You had Lee Danielson bring in the movie theater and the Ice Park, which was hugely controversial at the time. But again, you know, it's reasons for people to come downtown. And then ultimately, you know, Corin Capshaw, my employer, was able to strike the deal to put the pavilion in where the old Fridays After Five stage had been. And that, you know, opened a world of possibilities for, you know, truly national performing artists to come and play right downtown. So I think there's an argument to be made that, you know, that the live music scene as part of the broader art scene really was the driving force for creating what the downtown mall is today.
And when was that done?
The real critical mass kind of hit in 2004, 2005, because that's when the Paramount opened. That's when the Pavilion opened. And Live Arts moved into their new building and became much larger. And, you know, by then the restaurant scene was very well established. And you were seeing, this whole just instead of, you know, being able to roll a bowling ball down the mall at 7 o'clock and not hit anybody, there was foot traffic. You know, there was interest in, well, wait a minute, what's in that upper floor of the building? That'd be a great place to live. And landlords started to take those spaces and convert them into apartments. And, now you going kind of back to where we started here with, the old clubs, there's not those empty, unutilized spaces downtown. Every square foot is, got dollar signs attached to it, which makes it hard for a club owner, who's going to sell cheap beer and get people to come out and see live music. So
I actually was one of those people. I worked across the street downtown, my first job here in Charlottesville in 1990, we'll call it. And I called. There was a place called Spirit Visions Gallery.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And above it had a for lease sign. And I was looking for a place to live. And I said, I went and looked at it and I said, you know what? I would love to live right here. I called the landlord up. It was on the sign. He's still a landlord. I'm not going to say who it was. But I said, if you can run electric up there that I could plug a stove in and you put some plumbing in there, I could put a shower in, I'll build the whole thing out. It was a big retail space, short carpet, just like we have in here. And he said to me, why would anybody want to live on the downtown?
Yeah.
Literally. And this was a big landowner, and I never pursued it or anything. I didn't have that kind of capital. I was just looking for a place to,
just a dumb kid.
Dumb kid, yeah, exactly. But I also remember in that era, and what Kirby's talking about, the 91, 92, 93 seasons of Fridays at 5, it was on the Omni Inn with just a wooden stage built from, I believe, leftover stage materials from tracks.
Yeah.
But if you didn't go, like Friday started, there was for something for us to do on a Friday night, the whole office, let's go drink some beers, whatever, see some music. But Monday through Thursday, I always remember walking down there if you got off 4 or 5, there was no reason to go there because Downtown Athletic would close at 4:59 and a half. There was nothing down there going on until this all started.
I think Fridays really can be credited with making Charlottesville a hub of arts for the whole Central Virginia area too, because people come in from out of Charlottesville to do that. Like it's put us more on the map. It's sort of the combination of Fridays being this open venue that really draws people down, and then of course the success of the Dave Matthews Band, which just broadcast Charlottesville's name into the world.
What did you write about again, Stephen Barlin here? What did you write about during your time as Cripsy Duck? Because that seems to be a year or two before the time period that Kirby has given us the pavilion and Fridays After Five blew up the downtown mall.
Well, I'd been a musician in town for about 12 years, and it seemed like the only people who were getting any press were people with press kits, usually from out of town, or people who knew the people who worked at the paper. There wasn't, nobody was piercing into the small local restaurants and bars and finding these bands and giving them a little bit of print that they could, put in their press kits. So I just pitched the idea to go out and start doing this to the editor, and he was uninterested. So I went out and just wrote some reviews and sent them in, and he was like, all right, we'll talk. And I used this silly pseudonym, Cripsy Duck, which was a typo from a Chinese menu on the corner. But the idea was I would go out and do sort of poor man's Hunter S. Thompson kind of thing, where I would just go and drink a lot and then write a story about the crazy night that I'd have, where I would describe these various bands that I would see. And it was always my thrust was always to sort of describe them in such a way that anybody could understand what I was talking about, even if you'd never heard the genre or had no familiarity. So I was going to Tokyo Rose, to Michael's Bistro, to the Buddhist Biker Bar and Grill, to any of the venues who would let me in, Tracks, and these places were kind enough to let me come down and not pay ticket price, so I could go in and just catch 45 minutes of a show and then go write my thumbnail of what I saw there. And so that's what I did for about 2 years, right around the millennium.
Again, our guests, Stephen Barlin, Kirby Hutto, Rich Tarbell, talking about the history of Charlottesville music, a lot of it based on Rich's book regarding Charlottesville music and oral history. You can go to the website.
RichTarbell.com, pick up the book, and look at the new movie documentary I just uploaded.
There you go. We shall be right back. And here we are back in action talking about music. Nothing beats music, whether you're having a good day or a bad day. You can always find the music to help along with that. And Charlottesville is full of music. So two places that we need to get make sure to get into the hour, Trax and Miller's. So let's start with Miller's. Stephen, you were mentioning how Miller's has a key place. So since we're still on the downtown mall, let's talk about Miller's.
Sure.
Jump in.
Well, Miller's has always supported, you know, it was sort of taken over and was sort of an artsy venue in the, I guess, early, late 80s when it set up. And then the early 90s, and you had guys like John Dearth playing down there, who still has a residency every Thursday night. You know, guys like Tim Reynolds had a weekly gig on Monday nights, and Greg Howard. And these guys, for those of you who are unfamiliar, these are all sort of world-class jazz fusion-y guys. Like, these guys could be playing in Paris, and they would look right on Carnegie Hall stage and stuff. These are great artists. And this is before the Dave Matthews Band. So there's always been this, like, super high-quality fusion adult music thing happening down there. And that's just, they've sort of carried that. The modern Miller's sort of tries to carry that by having music every night of the week. John still has his Thursday nights with various killer jazz heavies from around, and also a bunch of his students come down and play with him every Thursday. And it's just fabulous. If you go in there, you're going to see what, you know, modern jazz would look like if it was super vibrant everywhere. That's what's happening there. So that's crucial. Yeah.
How about, you know, some of the more unique places, the venues that are mentioned in the book that we haven't talked about, that you can find in Charlottesville? Tokyo Rose.
There's one.
Hell yeah.
All right. Tokyo Rose is, again, you know it. You've seen it in the little strip shopping center there, towards the end of town where the basketball arenas are, on 250. It's still a top sushi restaurant, but the owner back in those days, and we're talking the 90s there, mid-90s, Atsushi had, well, you wouldn't, Atsushi Steven Mina. Actually would do this story better, but real quick, I'll just lead in to say it was a basement venue. Again, we have there this theme running with this. But
it was in Charlottesville.
Underneath exactly. The nice sushi restaurant.
And it was dark and what have you. Went downstairs, and they had a wide variety of music, actually, and some pretty big national acts came through. Slater Kinney's the one that always blows my mind, that mm-hmm. You know, they can draw 1,000 people in any city they want these days if they, you know, they've reformed a little bit, but they, you know, they came to Charlottesville and played to 75 people. But but you can speak to Tokyo Rose. You were close to that whole thing.
I was
wrote
lucky
a song
enough to,
about it.
Yeah, I was lucky enough to be in Atsushi's band for a while. Atsushi was is a Japanese man who owned that restaurant, and for some reason he saw fit to allow a bunch of punks and goths to take over his basement, and so that they would regularly do punk shows down there and had weekly goth nights. And those kind of, like Rich said earlier, it's hard for these people to find venues because they're usually young and they don't drink a lot. They're not making a lot of money. And sometimes they get rowdy and out of control and they break stuff. So a lot of people don't want to work with them. But Atsushi put up with them for years and years, and they called his place home. And he was sort of their mascot. Atsushi himself wrote these. He was really influenced by Roy Orbison and the Beatles, and he wrote these like sort of sweetly super sad songs and then would perform them, and they would, all these punks would get down there and cheer wildly for this older Japanese guy playing these Beatles songs. But it was really important to that whole crowd. It was, you know, one of the last real official punk venues where you could actually charge a cover and have a door guy and a real bar and stuff. So now you got to put those shows into, I guess, the Southern or something. I don't even know what you do with a show like that.
I think now, and then we talked about this a little before we started the show, is now those are the places that have been kind of, I don't want to say pushed aside. It's just a matter of economics where there's no vacant space. Random Row Books, I think, was the last place to kind of have
that
those.
Was sort of the last holdout.
The last holdout where, and that was a bookstore. They didn't even have alcohol, but they would host bands and community meetings and things like that. Ian McKay from McFagazi's came down with his band, the Evens and stuff. But now there's just limited space because everything, like Kirby mentioned earlier with the Downtown Mall, is booked. Rented. There is no place for those type of shows. I mean, really, again, it goes back to going to be creative. Some people do those at Ick's Art Park now. They have a little concert space tucked away there, or the outdoor space, and you can go. Like I know Shagwolf, as we mentioned Sally Rose earlier, Shagwolf has a band, a show May 25th, their 5th anniversary show. They went and said, we want to put this big production on. They're going to have all sorts of things going on. They have to think, where can I do that? They could have done it at the Southern, but there's limited things that go on there. It's a, you know, it's a pretty straightforward venue, and they want to be creative and have fire dancers and all this stuff going on. You have to make your own space in Charlottesville now. Mm-hmm. And it's the, you know, with the gentrification of this town, I hate to sound like grumpy old guy and throw a word like gentrification around. There's this limited rough that we keep saying basement spaces to be had anymore.
Why is, and maybe I'm not correct because I'm old and grumpy, but why has Dave Matthews Band been the only band to be nationally successful? I mean, we've had Seattle bands.
It's not entirely true. Not entirely true.
Okay.
It is mostly true, but it's not.
But Seattle, Athens, Minneapolis, am I wrong to be comparing size-wise because Seattle and Minneapolis are so much larger?
Well, you can go Athens and Charlottesville is about the same size, but they've had different things happen.
But how am I wrong in the fact that, you know, Dave Matthews and you're telling me that I'm not entirely correct?
It's not 100%.
First, and then get into the second part of the question.
Well, there are other bands. You have the Hackensaw Boys have done very well. Corey Harris has done very well. Yeah. I mean, there is some other people who placed nationally out of Charlottesville in the last 25 years.
But that's not quite like REM and B-52s.
At all.
If we want to compare.
None, no.
If we want to compare same size cities.
I was asked to write about this, actually,
okay,
in like 2000. And my thesis at the time was that we just lack the suburban compression of a Seattle. We have actually such a smaller population that there's a different, you know, competition and collaboration model here. You know, the venues, there are fewer venues, there are fewer people going out to see local acts. There's not the same kind of support locally. I mean, we survive on the university students, and they're sort of disinterested from local arts. They're not into it that much, so I don't think they push on it that hard. I think those are some of the factors that why we don't have a B-52s and REM-style Athens scene.
And the other thing I think is, I think I talked to Rob Sheffield a lot about this. In some of these towns, like Chapel Hill, we have the same university type of thing, same size town, same feel of the town, but they have Merge Records there. And from their music scene, they had other infrastructure there, whether it be record distribution or exposure or media outlets.
Management.
Yeah. So it's just a matter of luck and timing. And we haven't had, I mean, you say there's not been another Dave Matthews, but there are people that may have made a living their whole life, like Corey Harris, playing just music. None of them became millionaires, but
he got a genius grant.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The MacArthur Award. So there are people there, you know, John DeEarth made a living doing nothing but music and teaching people and helping people, and Daryl Rose, and there are people that do it. It's just that Dave Matthews thing was an anomaly.
Yeah, I think Korn's vision was singular.
It just happened. Maybe it couldn't even happen today. Say they started today. You know, there were some things in place there. There was skill and strategy, but there's also luck.
Well, there was also an infrastructure to launch bands nationwide. I mean, I was just reading the other day in an industry blog, you know, that Dave Matthews and Coldplay were kind of the last of the bands who got their launch off of music videos. You know, you had VH1 and MTV were still actually playing videos. And that provided them a platform that gave them that nationwide exposure. Korn then leveraged that. I mean, that's, that's an industry that he just created from nothing. Was a lot of other great, talented local bands kind of got right there to the cusp, but never broke through.
Well, there's a mention in the book about how Indecision might have been just at the wrong time, but if they'd been, a year or two ahead or a year or two later that they might have been able to do what Dave Matthews Band has done.
They pumped the brakes when they should have been stepping on the gas.
Yep.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that's the other thing from knowing all these musicians. I mean, you'll get a band who gets there and it's like, okay, now we just have to go tour nationwide for 6 months. And somebody goes, oh, I don't want to do that. I want to stay home.
Hogwaller Ramblers,
for instance. Yeah, right. You know, way back the Sitting Ducks. You know, they got signed. New York City recording studio was booked for them, and they all just kind of went, whoa, wait a second, we don't want this. Too much. And it's...
Well, that's a lot of guys to keep on a dirty old bus.
Yeah, for sure.
I don't know that I'd want to do that either.
It's not an easy life.
Speaking of them, and I want to talk about them for a second, but I feel the need, let's chat for a second about Blue Moon Diner, because I want to talk about Sidney Tapscott.
Oh, yeah.
And about how those two things go together in a community of Charlottesville and Charlottesville music.
So the Blue Moon Diner is my favorite venue now as I get older, where you can see some magic on certain nights where you might be sitting there with 12 other people. But Jim Wade's playing over there in the corner, and he should be playing in Nashville or something.
It's no just, mics, nothing. No he's just mics, standing there just with a guitar.
One guitar. His set's 8 to 10 on Wednesday nights. He'll show up at 7:58, and he'll be playing at 8, and he'll quit at 10:01, and he gets his supper, and he goes home. Two straight hours, no breaks. That's unbelievable. Just the talent level there. Now, and I will say real quick, Blue Moon Diner, for those, again, it's been closed for about 2 years with renovations. We're building more condos or what have you. They will reopen. And when it does, hopefully the space remains the same. That's the idea. But that's one of the good venues for acoustic performers when they're trying to cut their, you know, or learn their chops or what have you. That's a good welcoming place with an audience that will, you know, like I said, it might be 12 people, it might be 25, whatever. They'll listen and they'll be appreciative and play. But that's a little bit about the Blue Moon Diner, but Steven would probably talk about Sidney Tapscott a little more than I could.
I mean, Sidney was a classic local character. He was an older man with, like...
I used to see him... I used to see him in Old Cabell Hall all the time.
He owned Old Cabell Hall. He was the mayor of Old Cabell Hall.
I mean, that's where I was a sociology grad.
He would get on you.
where I saw him. And then I would see him in Seville Weekly, you know, with his harmonica or whatever. I'd be like, what? I know that guy.
Sidney had developmental disability. So he was a little bit of a special friend, and he would wander up and down Main Street, and he would volunteer to clean things and then insist on being paid, which was kind of his M.O. So he would sweep out in front of your shop where you were working, and then he'd come and go, give me some tobacco, you know? And like you're like, okay, what, Sidney? And you'd buy him tobacco or whatever. But he became sort of a mascot to several local bands, including the Hogwaller Ramblers and the Hackensaw Boys, both of whom sort of took him in and, I mean, used him in a friendly way on their records, like they would have recordings, because he liked to perform, and he would do this routine where he would take his harmonica and he would do a pretend Grand Ole Opry radio show, and he would get up and say, you know, now we're going to hear, you know, Best in the West, and then he'd play, you know, by the Tennessee Ramblers. He'd get the name of the band wrong.
Always
and he'd
up
play
the name
something
of the band
on the harmonica, and then he would announce a different song, and he'd play the same thing on the harmonica, and he always had the name of the band wrong. Right. he was a classic older guy. He was just like somebody that everybody protected and looked to.
Well, yeah, he lived down at the Midway Apartments, you know, down at the end Midway of West Manor. Main Street, mm-hmm. You know, right before you get to the mall. So that, you know, the Blue Moon was kind of his home away from home, and he was there all the time.
Yeah,
and I think the special place the Blue Moon had. And this goes back, you know, to the Mineshaft days and the Tracks days. You know, the Blue Moon in its current incarnation was opened by Buzzy White, who booked Muddy Waters into the West Virginia and, you know, was involved in the music scene. So all the touring bands knew, come to the Blue Moon Diner and get your lunch before you go on the road. So you'd see somebody in the club that night, and then the next day, they'd be there in the Blue Moon Diner eating breakfast. And it was a great way to sort of build that community. And God, I spent way more hours in the Blue Moon Diner in the 80s than I should have, but it was home. And Yeah, you got to sit down and actually talk to these people, you know, and give them advice about, oh, you know, here's a place you should consider playing the next time. Yeah, it really filled a niche.
56 after the hour, just a couple minutes left with our guest, Rich Tarbell. His book regarding Charlottesville music, you can find it on his website.
RichTarbell.com or New Dominion Bookshop down in the downtown mall, everybody's favorite bookshop in Charlottesville.
Kirby Hutto here is the GM at Sprint Pavilion. What's your big show coming up?
The next ticketed concert is Rodrigo y Gabriela on June 5th. But we're loading up on the back end of the schedule. So SprintPavilion.com will show you everything that's happening. But, you know, a lot of big shows will be coming in July, August, September, and probably even into November if one that is on the calendar confirms.
Stephen Barling here, Barling and Collins, also still working, doing some things musically.
Still play every Sunday at Miller's, including tonight.
You got to give out. How many years have you been playing Miller's every Sunday night? 12?
15.
Yeah. 15. we haven't really hit on tracks much other than hit and miss. It is where Dave Matthews Band really got their legs under them and took off onto the scene.
Again, like the Mineshaft, everybody remembers those glory days, and that's where I spent a lot of time too. I can reel off my favorite concert, the Ramones and Dinosaur Jr. with My Bloody Valentine. Mm-hmm. And you know, I didn't even understand what My Bloody Valentine was now or was then. I mean, I liked them, but it's like now that would be a 25,000 seater if those two paired up. But again, it was one of those things, and Andy Waldeck has a great quote in the book. It's like, you remember it as this glorious place, but it was a roadhouse, and again, it was pretty much a dump. Andy said, it was dark, it was dank, it smelled like beer, and it was beautiful.
Yeah.
Because that's your, you know, we have now in Charlottesville, we do have truly beautiful venues, not those kind of
funky,
weird. Yeah. The things we went into to see music back in the day is kind of crazy to think about now. When you go to a place like the Jefferson, which is national level beautiful.
It's pristine, yeah. Cool. I mean, it's a whole different world, and it's a different economy. I mean, you can't...
Absolutely.
You know, when you're paying bands those guarantees and you're in a really nice place with a really nice sound system, it's different economics.
Nobody has $1 beers.
No. Thankfully, for some,
I think you can get a $2 PBR at Miller's.
Oh, right. On Sunday nights?
Yeah, on Sunday nights with Brian Collins.
The $1 shot, or maybe it's a $1 shot. The $2.
Gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having us. So it's fun. Every time we do this, it's like the hour flies by. Yeah. We could talk for another hour, no problem.
I feel like I learned stuff, too.
I appreciate it. There's tons of stuff that we didn't get out to. Chris Farina, Corner Parking Lot.
Yes.
He really did a lot to
support musicians.
Employ them. Yeah, I feel like I should throw his name out there. All right, let's finish it up. I know my producer wants us to do this thing. Next week we'll be talking with the Jefferson Madison Regional Library about what you should be reading for the summer. Adios, my friends.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Strength is in their fuel. Engineering assistance is from Mike Friend. The Wake-Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at SevillePodcast.com. Be sure and join Rick next Sunday morning for another edition of The Wake-Up Call, only on 94.7 WPVC.